Under the radar means hearing about things you didn't know you needed to know until you hear them.
It's a serious look.
You hear about the issues that don't get the attention they deserve.
Under the radar doesn't get caught up in the day-to-day.
Surfacing issues that are not talked about in mainstream media.
I think it's something that connects us to each other.
Under the radar is all about discovery.
I can be guaranteed voices I haven't heard before.
But also the questions.
Under the radar is one step ahead.
I'm Callie Crossley. This week on Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, Governor Maura Healey opposes a potential ballot question that would eliminate the MCAS test as a requirement for high school graduation, opposition that puts her at odds with the Massachusetts Teachers Union backing the question. And from immigration to reproductive rights, issues that ignited the country in the last presidential election will be relitigated in the rematch between President Biden and former President Trump. As the contest heats up, former President Trump's speeches are reaching new levels of violent rhetoric. Plus, what are the takeaways from Super Tuesday's elections that may indicate trouble or triumph for both parties heading to November? That and more during our full hour with the Mass Politics Profs. Joining me, Erin O'Brien, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts Boston. Hello, Erin.
Good to be here.
It's good to have you. Gerald Duquette, Professor of Political Science and Director of the Public Policy and Management Program at Central Connecticut State University. Hi, Gerald.
Hello. Very happy to be with you.
Glad to have you. And Mo Cunningham, former Associate Professor of Political Science at UMass Boston. Welcome back, Mo.
Kelly, it's great to be back.
All three members of the Mass Politics Profs blog. All right, let's jump in with Governor Healey making her opposition known to a potential ballot question that would eliminate MCAS as a graduation mandate. Here she is talking to WBUR about that.
I think that assessment is important. We need to be able to assess how our young people are doing, so I do not support getting rid of MCAS. I think there's a question about what do we do for young people, and there are about 700 each year who are unable to pass MCAS and therefore do not receive a high school diploma. We've got to find a way to take care of those young people.
Now, I was unaware, maybe I just missed it, that she'd had any kind of feelings about this at all prior to this moment. Did I miss it? Mo, what did you know about Governor Healey and the MCAS test?
No, I don't know that you missed it. It took me a little bit by surprise as well. Certainly, it's always significant, the governor's position on anything, but in a ballot question, not terribly significant. Remember, Charlie Baker led the charge for charters in a ballot question 8 years ago, and actually studies showed that Baker, as popular as he was, actually hurt the side he was on. And so politically, it may not be significant, but then, you know, whatever side you're on, you'd much prefer to have the governor with you.
Yes. And in this case, however, Erin, she's going up against the Mass Teachers Union, which would not seem to be a group that she would want to go up against.
Yep. Who Nelly? I mean, you don't see a Democratic governor regularly going against the teachers unions, and the Massachusetts teacher unions are strong. I mean, it suggests to me that she has a real policy preference. You know, if she's willing to go against the teachers union, then she must feel pretty strongly about that. We heard her argument that assessment is important. Personally, I agree. As an educator, we assess all the time. My students are taking a midterm, you know, that kind of thing. So, but politically, it is big when a Democratic governor chooses to go against the teachers union. But again, she did it on the strike as well. So she's showing some real policy preferences, even if Massachusetts voters might not reward her for them.
Now, Gerald, director of the Public Policy and Management Program at Central, let me ask this question, because there appears not to be on hand anyway, at least we've heard from her or anybody else, a substitute for the assessment should it go away. And we figured the Mass Teachers Union are going to fight for it to go away, but then what?
Well, it's actually not going away. It's simply not being used as a
grant. Well, that's true.
And
yes.
I would say that this is just another reason for my latest essay title, which is Democratic Trifectas in Massachusetts Ain't All What They're Cracked Up to Be.
And your point being,
that the Democratic governor, it may well be that progressives assumed that electing a Democratic governor was going to be a huge boon to their progressive agenda. And in her campaign, I think Mara Healey made it clear that she was more interested in governing like the previous governor, who was not a Democrat, and also not making the mistakes of the last Democrat, Deval Patrick, who did, in fact, go a little too far to the left and found himself in hot water with legislative leaders.
I mean, Gerald, I think you make an important point, because part of the opposition, such as it was against her during the campaign, was that she was going to do exactly what you just said.
Progressives didn't like her.
Yes, exactly. They were saying, this is exactly what we can expect, and you're going to be sorry. So anyway, they ignored that, obviously. All right. Another very focused piece that is just, I think we discussed this once some time ago. This sex education law, which is really just to update the Healthy Youth Act in Massachusetts, which has not been updated in forever, so that you have correct information that is relevant to young people now. And these people who have been trying to get this through, this is now the fifth time, just cannot make it happen. I believe the last time we discussed this, Aaron, the issue, as you pointed out, was it's because there is a piece of this that pays attention to rights of LGBTQ students. Though, let me say, none of the districts are required to take this course on. If this passes, they are not required. They can opt out. So I'm still at a loss as to what is the issue about getting this through.
Sure. As I understand it, that Massachusetts, we updated our sex ed policies. You know, it had taken 20 years, but then the Healthy Youth Act would take it even further. And it would kick in that we would automatically revisit these policies every 10 years. And the Senate, the Massachusetts State Senate, has passed it 5 times. But as we know, the House is more conservative and has not passed it for exactly the reasons you state, Callie. Even though there is an opt-out, parents can still say, I don't want my children involved in this. But it's supposed to be inclusive, and this is direct language, inclusive, reflect science, and updated every 5 years. So I was a little wrong there. And the concern that maybe the House just doesn't want to wade into is the idea that it would be medically accurate and talk about gender identity and sexual orientation when age appropriate. And of course, when age appropriate is what makes everyone nervous. Because some people might say 12, other people might say never.
But they can opt out. So I just.
Nothing with your rationality. but that's exactly it. And, you know, I have a student who, my Women in Politics class, who has been working on this. And so I was talking to her about it. And she was saying, and had data to support, that, you know, condom use is down for the first time individuals have sex, and usually that's in your teens. Testing for HIV and STDs is down. More women are reporting being sexually assaulted at a young age. So it seems that the Healthy Youth Act is particularly important, given some of the key indicators on sexual health and safety are going the wrong direction. 17 states require sex education to be medically accurate, and Massachusetts isn't one of them.
Before Gerald, you or Mo respond, let me just a comment from a spokesperson from the Jane Doe organization about why the Healthy Youth Act should be passed.
We can't ignore these conversations. We can't ignore, you know, hateful rhetoric that is floating around against queer and trans youth. We need our students to feel safe, feel heard, feel comfortable in their bodies.
All right. So pick it up from there, Mo.
Well, it's been my sad misfortune in the last few years to be studying groups like Moms for Liberty, Parents Defending Education, essentially right-wing, well-funded front groups that attack LGBTQ rights, among other things. And so it's discouraging to see an act to update sex ed laws struggling in Massachusetts, discouraging but not necessarily unforeseen, as Gerald likes to point out. It's not that progressive in some ways. There's a crying need on these sorts of issues, and young people are getting sex ed information off of TikTok, and they're getting it from conservative bloggers who are not teaching them scientifically proven ways to deal with their development. And it's really become much worse of a situation. And so it's something the legislature needs to address, and I hope they are finally ready to do it in the House.
Gerald.
I would say that for the House of Representatives, for Democrats in the House, in the last 5-10 years, they have existed in the same country that we have. They have seen a culture war all around them. But in fact, as we have commented often, we're actually kind of insulated. They're kind of insulated. They really should be able to pass this given that insulation. But I suspect that there is a level of fear among legislators. I suspect that this might be a situation where they are worried about opening Pandora's box when it comes to culture war issues. In Massachusetts, it has been a very long tradition for special interests to work very hard to avoid getting trapped into culture war debates. They are much more interested in economic development than culture war. Even Republicans in the state that are influential avoid the Trump, style culture warriors like the plague. So that all I can see is that sort of general orientation is holding things up. But I am surprised that they haven't been able to do this.
Well, I'm surprised, Gerald, because unlike some of these other culture war discussions that may result in policy that some people are very much not going to like and protest against in some of the groups that you mentioned, this has an exit door. So isn't this what those groups say? The parents should decide. District should decide. Okay, decide. What does that have to do with the passing, the updating of the law? It just seems weird. And so to your point, I guess people just decide not worth it.
They don't want students in, and this is air quoting, I know it's radio, permissive culture, right? And even if I pull my kid out because I don't agree with this this sex ed, especially the talk about gender identity and sexual orientation, they don't like that other kids that my kid's going to be around would be exposed to these ideas. So it's definitely fear-based and it's definitely culturally based because they, Callie, to your point, they don't want just an out for their kid. They want an out for all kids or all kids to be educated in ways that are completely reflective of their own views. They think it should be one-to-one.
Mm. The out is for rational calculation. Rational calculation has nothing to do with identity.
That's a good point.
I know we usually talk about the culture war issue. I don't use the term culture war anymore. I think it's a war on equality. Mm. It is a war on recognizing each individual's right to be as they are and to develop into the human beings that they truly are. And that's what's at issue here, that there's a quelling and a silencing of LGBTQ plus individuals. It is a war on equality, and you see it right across the board with right-wing politics today. That's the way I look at it.
If you're just tuning in, this is Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. I'm Callie Crossley, and here with me are three members of the Mass Politics Profs blog, Erin O'Brien, Associate Professor of Political Science at UMass Boston, Gerald Duquette, Professor of Political Science at Central Connecticut State University, and Mo Cunningham, former Associate Professor of Political Science at UMass Boston. We're discussing political news in Massachusetts and nationwide. Mo, I'm going to let you have at it on the Governor's Council confirming a new appointee by Governor Maura Healey, whom she knows very well, Gabrielle Wolohogian, 6-1. And as is quoted by the one person who voted against her, Tara Jacobs, saying you couldn't have a more insider nominee. I will point out this is the Governor's Council, and there you go. All right, Mo, I'll let you start.
A lot of us are familiar with a wonderful novel, I think written in the 50s, called The Last Hurrah. The main character was Frank Skeffington, not so loosely based on James Michael Curley. If the author had put in that book that that the Curley character was going to appoint his former live-in partner to the SJC, I think the book would have been rejected as, you know, far too absurd for even the long history of Irish politicians padding offices with their close friends. And so, I'm a little bit stunned it hasn't been a bigger issue. It deserves to be. This is a state with endless supplies of well-qualified attorneys who could be on the SJC for many, many years. This nominee will have to leave in 7 years. I assume Governor Healey figures she'll be reelected, and then she can name the successor. But this is really just... It's just out of the old Irish, I'll take care of your back, take care of my back playbook.
You feel the same way, Gerald?
So my problem with her approach was she didn't say it as plainly as I think it needs to be said. The problem here is very simple. This is a violation of the appearance of conflict of interest ethical standard. It is a very clear violation of that standard. Now, my problem is we're living in a country where a Supreme Court justice is laying waste to that, and I feel bad that a nominally progressive Massachusetts governor is not setting a better example in an environment where right-wing judges are laying waste to the standard that she has, it seems to me, chosen to ignore.
Last comment, Aaron.
You know, I think Gerald nailed it. I will say, though, that Maura Healey has much better relationship with her exes than I do. Just, no, but no, I wouldn't nominate them to anything. But,
and I'm with you.
Yeah. I mean, the devil's advocate on this is that the individual does appear to be qualified. But as Mo pointed out, we are a state with an embarrassment of riches when it comes to legal minds. And you're responsible as governor both not to be corrupt and not to give the look that is corrupt. So it's a bad choice, and it's beneath Governor Healey's office to have pursued this.
Another local bill to just make note of that seems to have full support, at least in the Senate, is one that would increase... we'll make it easier for families to afford childcare, which in Massachusetts is crazy expensive. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just out of bounds. And of course, this has ways to go. It has to go through the House. But, you know, so a lot of enthusiasm for this bill. I will note that nobody said where the money's coming from, but okay, small thing. Aaron, what do you think?
This is so necessary. According to the Institute for Women's Policy Research, Massachusetts is 49th in childcare affordability. It's an index, so there's other measures. Any individual with a child or a child in their life, somehow friend, aunt, uncle, childcare is just a complete budget killer, and it makes living in Massachusetts incredibly difficult. So anything the legislature can do, and the Senate has passed this unanimously, to make major investments in childcare affordability, quality, getting more individuals involved. There is a part of this that's loan forgiveness for childcare providers who take care of our young people, our young kids, and get paid, you know, barely above minimum wage in many things. So this is a place where Massachusetts is literally the very, very back of the pack amongst the 50 states. And everyone in the Commonwealth suffers, regardless of whether or not they have a child in their home. So this is exciting legislation that Democrats and Republicans, at least in the Senate, could uniformly agree in. It's good policy.
Gerald?
It's obviously good policy, and I don't think it's necessarily problematic. I would be surprised if they couldn't get this across the finish line. I can certainly attest with my four children that daycare was a quite a bit of money. In fact, it rivals college tuition, another thing that unfortunately I paid for.
Mo.
Didn't we cut taxes for some reason last year? I'm trying to remember.
Oh, you thought for childcare?
Well, if there's funding needed, and there obviously is, and I was unaware of something Erin said, which is with a 49th in childcare. It's absolutely critical. It's critical for the economy. I mean, young people in the 20s, 30s, even 40s who have young children, they have to be able to go to work, and they have to feel completely confident that their children are receiving warm-hearted professional care. And so the care workers have to be compensated properly, and there have to be proper supports for this. So again, with my caveat about wondering about the tax cut, I agree with my colleagues that this is one that should go through.
The only headwinds I could see, of course, is the billion-dollar hole in revenue projection. I was at an event last night and heard state legislators cautioning the crowd when they're asking for various funding sources that there's going to be a billion-dollar hole in, and that, of course, makes me think of those tax cuts again, Mo. And so if there's a headwind to something so commonsensical, it would be that.
I would just add, though, this is one of those situations, because it's so critically important, that you could see businesses stepping up. This seems to me to have a lot of private-public partnership possibilities. There's a state, and I'm sorry I can't remember the name of it, that did something I think is amazing. They are building housing to retain their early childhood educators in the state, because they can't afford, they can't afford anything. They're not paid well. And so the housing is the biggest draw to keep them in the state, wherever it is that I cannot remember now. I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah. It taps into Healy's affordable housing.
Yeah,
You know, that's exciting policy. And I think, Kelly, you're 100% correct that, you know, this is a public-private partnership. All these chamber of commerce that, you know, if self-interest works sometimes, if there's self-interest, business interest, stab quality childcare, then fine. I might come at it from like a women's rights, morality perspective. But if economic self-interest floats your boat, great. As long as we can get this policy through.
Exactly. All right. Let's switch gears to national politics, of which there's a lot.
Do we have to?
There's so much going on. It's dizzying. I don't even know. This is why most people are just can't keep up with it right now, because it just feels so overwhelming. I thought maybe we could anchor from Super Tuesday, that now feels like there's a long time ago. But I'm more interested in what you all's take is about what came out of Super Tuesday, what signals you're seeing or not that indicates something for either party or both. I mean, I think we can all agree so far this is just going to be a nasty campaign all the way to November. But aside from that piece, which we can get into more in a minute, what are some of the telltale signs, Mo, you think, coming out of Super Tuesday that we should be paying attention to?
A lot of commentary is focused on the relatively weak performances of both Trump and Biden among certain constituencies in their parties. I tend to think over time people come home in their parties. And so, certainly Biden has a little bit bigger problem there, but I think people come home. So I wouldn't focus so much on that. The thing I think to focus on is that MAGA has been a failure at the ballot box in 2018, 2020, and 2022. So I think, Kelly, you're right that it will be an extremely negative campaign. I mean, any campaign with Donald Trump on one side is going to be negative. But I think perhaps the key for the Democrats is to focus on highlighting the awfulness of MAGA, because when MAGA is on the ballot, it loses continuously. When the Democrats don't focus on MAGA, as they did not in some congressional districts, for example, in New York and California 2 years ago, then Republicans get a slide. But as long as MAGA is on the ballot, the Democrats, no matter what the analysis is of what happened in March or February of 2024 for a November vote, I think if the focus is on MAGA, the Democrats have a reasonable expectation. In other words, don't panic at Biden's poll numbers in the New York Times in March, because it isn't March when we have the vote. It's November, and a lot's going to happen.
Okay.
Including a possible conviction of the president in one of the four criminal cases against him.
I just have to say, I don't think that man is ever going to be convicted, so I don't put that on the list. But maybe I'm wrong. But you are the political professionals. All right, jump in, Gerald. What's your take?
Mo is not wrong when he says that the president seems to have a bigger problem getting his getting folks to come home. But on the other hand, the reason that he seems to have that problem is because the folks who are voting against him in these primaries are making a policy stand, right? They're policy-minded voters. And we know that as such, they're a very small percentage of the voters. On the other side, you have folks who probably aren't nearly as policy-oriented. So on the one hand, policy-oriented voters seem like they're going to dig in their heels more. On the other hand, the outrageousness of MAGA has made it pretty clear that there is a constituency. There remains a small but not unclear never Trump constituency in the sort of Lincoln Project mold on the in the Republican Party. And I think something that's going to mean more than it currently looks like it's going to mean would be the dozens of former Trump officials, including his vice president, who have essentially said he doesn't belong anywhere near the White House again. So ultimately, the Biden's problem, I think Biden's progressive critics will come home, because I think that at the end of the day, he is reaching out. He is speaking more harshly about Netanyahu. He is moving in the direction they want to go. And at the end of the day, they are simply not going to make the same mistake that it was perceived that some made in 2016. They are not going to help elect Donald Trump.
So, Aaron, if Mo is correct and people come home in the end, do the Nikki Haley people go home to Trump then?
You know, it's an open question. I'm a lot more negative than my two of my favorite people, Mo, are Mo and Gerald. And my analysis is a little different in that I do agree that they mostly come home, but that doesn't mean you turn out. It means you might have a soft preference for, you know, you want Biden more than Trump. But if you're, you know, a Muslim American, or if you're of Palestinian descent, it's going to be really hard to pull that lever for Joe Biden, and for some, impossible. And the margins were so, so tight in 2020. You know, when MAGA has been on the ballot, it lost in 2020, to Mo's point, and in 2022. But you know, Donald Trump is back on the ballot, not a proxy, someone actually named Donald Trump. And that can cut both ways. But we're seeing in a lot of the polling, not in who voters prefer in terms of Biden or Trump, but voters are increasingly remembering the Trump years differently than they were. And there's more distance. It's why you can look fondly back on times and, you know, the rough spots of memory get edged out. So the polls that show the economy was better under Trump, well, that's just not true. But if voters feel it's true, that matters. So I think if you're someone who wants to see Joe Biden win, you should be concerned. You should be deeply concerned, because it only takes a couple, maybe 100,000 voters in some of these key states. And those voters are remembering the Trump years differently. And Trump voters want to turn out for him. Some voters might strongly dislike elements of MAGA, but they like Donald Trump. You know, like they like the guy at the top of the pyramid. So when I looked at Super Tuesday, nobody knows for sure, but my analysis is, if I were betting right now, I would bet on Donald Trump. I don't like Vegas. I'm not a bettor. Both of them have work to do to bring their voters home. But I think, progressives and the Democratic caucus, those are harder cats to wrangle in than the Republican Party has shown. I think they will come home. And Trump is just, to Gerald's concern, been so normalized. We've talked about a lot, but the normalization continues. So I am a glass half empty gal today.
Well, let me pick up on your just 100,000 votes, because I'm looking at a press release from a group called the Coalition Activate, and they are noting that an estimated over 110,000 Illinois voters who went to the polls on Tuesday, March 19th, did not vote for Joe Biden. They did, uncommitted, which is a a movement that's been happening during some of the primaries. And I want to follow that up with former Ohio State Senator Nina Turner telling ABC News that the uncommitted movement plans to continue pressuring the president through the general election this fall.
President Joe Biden is weakening himself by not calling for a permanent ceasefire and answering the humanitarian calls of the Palestinian people, both in the Gaza, and we also know some Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank. I mean, Lindsay, only a vote for Trump is a vote for Trump. So people who are claiming that a vote of uncommitted is somehow helping President Donald J. Trump, they're wrong. I mean, I thought choice in a primary is supposed to be the bedrock of democracy.
So that was interesting, a strong statement. So we'll see. I mean, we don't know, right?
Mathematically, in the primary, he's correct. In the general, she's incorrect.
Yeah, I think, you know, voting against Biden in a primary in March, it's a freebie. Mm-hmm. When the vote comes down to November, it's going to be Donald Trump against Joe Biden. I don't disagree with Aaron that some of these concerns will persist, but it's not a freebie anymore. You really have to make a decision that is going to help determine who the next president of the United States will be. It's a whole different thing. There are no free passes on this one.
It's also important to point out that they're policy oriented people, and they're an uncommitted, not against him. They're uncommitted. I think of it as a perfectly healthy way to try to make what they want, you know, more likely to happen. The way they're couching it is actually, they're not even saying they're not going to vote for him in the general election. They're saying it is our role here is to try to make this president understand what we want him to do. And I don't think there's anything inconsistent about it. And I would argue they're probably not going to be using the same rhetoric in July or August.
Okay. Lightning round from all of you. Does former Vice President Mike Pence saying he could not in good conscience endorse former President Trump mean anything?
No.
Oh,
Gerald. Oh, who? Okay. Mo.
When put together with the 24 other officials from the first term, it could.
Well, we're going to take a break. Coming up, more insight and analysis from the Mass Politics Profs. This is Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. I'm Callie Crossley. I'm Callie Crossley, and this is Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. We're continuing our full hour discussion with three members of the Mass Politics Profs blog, Aaron O'Brien and Mo Cunningham of UMass Boston, and Gerald Duquette from Central Connecticut State University. All right, let's continue on looking at national politics. There's a number of issues that are out there that are going to, you know, come back again as though they never left. One of them is the fight for the Latino vote. So we know that President Biden headed to Arizona to try to mobilize the vote. And we know that former President Trump has been aligning himself with Latin American right-wing stars to bring home the U.S. Latino vote or make connections in a way. And it was working for some. I don't know what the numbers are. Nobody can tell. Again, we're still in March. But it is working somewhat. So I want to get your take on that. Luis is not with us, but let's talk about the battle over the Latino voters yet again between President Biden and former President Trump.
The old assumption that minorities, racial minorities, ethnic minorities, are natural constituents of the Democratic Party, data has been telling us for some years now that hasn't really worked out. I think Joe Biden is approaching this in a way that makes sense. He is basically playing this as an economic class game. He's playing the FDR role here. He's actually doing what Senator Warren has always tried to do. She makes this about something that isn't identity based, but rather she makes it about poverty. She makes it about opportunity cost. So she, I think he is, he's making the right decision in going after these people on bread and butter economic issues rather than attempting to appeal to identity.
Mo?
Yeah, and I think over time, the outright racism that he bring, that Trump brings to his politics, I think has to cut against this sort of appeal. I do understand that what polling says, but I do. I'm going to be a broken record and come back to MAGA, which is enormously unpopular. And when you consider the some of the things he talks about, calling migrants vermin and other things. You know, we all pay extremely close attention to politics, but most people pay no attention to politics. And so I think if the Democrats are smart in making these sorts of racist remarks by Donald Trump and his MAGA acolytes part of the campaign, then I think you'll see movement in that area back toward the Democrats.
Aaron.
I would say a couple of things. One, Luis is not here, but I've had the good fortune to read his book and some of his articles and more. And, you know, he writes about remittances, but he also writes about, you know, the ways in which the politics of the origin country can affect views in the U.S., but the way individuals in the U.S. can affect the politics and viewpoints of individuals and in their family and the country of origin. So the original question of, you know, why is Trump appealing to some of these, you know, Latin American presidents and prime ministers that are on the far right is because you have calls to home and pulls to home. So, you know, as we all say, and you have all the time on the show, the Latinx community is far from uniform. So drawing on elements of home, because Donald Trump doesn't have to peel off every Latinx voter if he can get 6% more, 7% more. That is huge. These, you know, this is an at-the-margin election. And with that same frame of just peeling off, doing a little better in the Latinx community, you know, Mo rightfully pointed out some of the repugnant language that Donald Trump has used about undocumented immigrants. And a small minority, not all, of the Latinx community who came here and followed a really cumbersome immigration process in the United States are resentful of those individuals. I don't think that characterizes the whole of the community at all, but Donald Trump is just trying to get a higher percentage there. So that's what I think is going on in his appeals.
Now, we skirted around the bad rhetoric or the violent rhetoric that former President Trump has now seemingly amplified, which is a little surprising. One of the biggest comments was about a bloodbath. So let's listen to former President Trump, who said there would be a bloodbath if he lost the election.
We're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars if I get elected. Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole. That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
He also followed up at a later point talking about any Jewish person that voted for Biden was some horrible, was some traitor to the his religion and faith. You know, obviously a fair amount of blowback for those kinds of comments. But are we anesthetized? I think, Gerald, you were saying that it's become normalized. And so are people just like, yeah, that's what he says. But, you know, it's an exaggeration. To me, even though I've heard a lot of stuff that he said before that I thought was shocking, this crossed the line.
Well, I would say that the second comment is far more problematic for him, a real unforced error. Obviously, you know, the majority of Jewish voters are Democrats and vote for Democrats. The issue that is dogging the president, of course, has to do with Israel. And I think that was a comment that is going to resonate very negatively among Jewish voters. And I think it was even worse than the bloodbath comment. I actually had an interesting conversation about the comment with my students this morning. And of course, again, these are freshmen in an intro course, and when I play that for them, they say, "Well, he's talking about the economy." And I said, "Well, of course, if we isolated it, then that's true. But you know, this person has a context. This person has a record." So the reality is that I think he'll get the benefit of the doubt on a lot of this rhetoric for two reasons: one, the normalization issue, and two, the willingness of either people who are for him or people who are low information voters to give the benefit of the doubt to comments that they suspect might have been taken out of context. And again, you can only suspect that of Donald Trump if you're living under a rock. But as we understand, a bunch of Americans are effectively living under a rock because they don't pay attention to the news about politics.
Mo?
Well, I think it's incumbent upon all of us. And I mean, particularly, well, the Democrats, of course, have to have a role in this. But I think actually the news media as well, the idea that anybody takes this as normal kind of politics is just outrageous. And if you look at that speech, Professor Tim Snyder has a very good Substack on this. If you look at the totality of that speech, he starts with a patriotic song sung by the J6 chorus. He comes out and talks about how he's going to pardon them. Now, what he's talking about there is pardoning, is letting free people who are in prison for violent crimes done on his behalf and promising them that they get out, everything's okay, I'll take care of you, you can go ahead and commit more crimes if you want. And then he goes on and lightly covers his bloodbath statement with talking about automobile sales and so forth. No. It's very clear, and it's on all of us, and it's all our fault. If we let him get away with things like that, he meant exactly what he said. He is calling people toward a bloodbath. He will, if he is president, release people who will do his bidding in any bloodbath he seeks in the future. So I couldn't disagree more strongly with my good friend Gerald on this. I think the bloodbath comment is critically important and should gain a lot of attention. This isn't one of those things we should forget about and let it be yesterday's news.
The good thing is that the media seems to be doing that, though. I'm seeing, in my view, a change in coverage. I think there are efforts, serious efforts among journalists, not to do the same thing they've done in the past with regard to the former president. I think that they are going to do their best to try not to sort of be his mouthpiece by the sort of bogus neutrality that has hurt them so bad in the past.
I think they have a long way to go, and they haven't done this job in 7 years, so the pressure has to remain on them.
You know, sometimes you call balls and strikes as an umpire or a political scientist or a journalist, and sometimes you throw people out of the game. And comments like bloodbath have been normalized. There, if we heard that in 2000, our jaws would still be on the floor. So I do think, you know, sometimes people will critique professors. They shouldn't enter into politics. This is exactly when we should enter into politics, because we have historical context. We have comparative political science knowledge, journalists as well, to say that these kind of comments normalize violence. These kind of comments try to make heroes of insurrectionists violent insurrectionists. And so this isn't okay. This is new, and it is our job to say what the stakes are. Do you like a democracy or not? Because that's the stakes of this election when someone's making that kind of language. Don't fall for too clever by half anymore. He was talking about the auto industry. False. He wasn't. This is symbolic politics, and people will read on to this. So I think these comments, our job moving forward, it's been our job for a long time, and some of us have taken the job and not, is to not allow these comments to be just another Trumpy thing or just another Trump thing. This strikes at the very heart of democracy. Do you want it or not? Because it's on the ballot.
And I want to be clear about the exact quote about Jewish persons. He said, "Any Jewish person that votes for Democrats hates their religion. They hate everything about Israel, and they should be ashamed of themselves because Israel will be destroyed." He also said the Democratic Party hates Israel.
That commercial writes itself. You've got a Democratic commercial with a bunch of guys holding Nazi flags and Trump flags, and then you play the quote over it. That's devastating.
Well, speaking of commercials, there are a group of anti-Trump Republicans who've laid out $50 million as a plan of attack against former President Trump to get the attention of people who I guess are still very much supporting him and others who might be considering it. And they've already put their money into an ad. And let's listen to the ad.
A former Trump voter.
I voted for Donald Trump in 2016 and 2020.
In 2020, I voted for Trump again.
I will never support Donald Trump.
I will not vote for him in 2024.
He's got so much baggage.
Trump is the biggest threat to our democracy.
He kept denying
that he lost the election.
Donald Trump was responsible for the violence of January 6th.
He could have prevented it.
Trump talking about retribution.
Retribution and going after people
is disrespect of our military.
The military people that he's disgraced.
He'll never get my ever, ever.
And I want to be clear, the group is Republican voters against Trump. That was not; those were not Democratic voices. Those were actual Republican voters. And obviously some of them had a huge change of heart. What do you think about the impact of something like that? Does it resonate?
Kelly, can I'll jump in first because I think those voters are answering the question that four of us were just debating prior, that that we have to call this out as something different. The listeners to the show run the political gamut in a lot of ways. And if they can all agree as those voters saying that this is different and sort of they didn't say this, but I look forward to fighting you on more normal terms amongst Democrats and Republicans. But we have to unify and say, this is different. This is problematic. This is beyond party. This is about the country. Now, is that a frame that works? We certainly hope so. There is some evidence to suggest. But so I think it's a good campaign. And I do think it's answering the call that we all mutually agreed had to happen for this election.
Let me return to some of the other issues that are being relitigated, that one of them that appears to be working well for President Biden, and that is reproductive rights and justice. The Biden administration has put such a stake in the ground about this that Vice President Harris, for the very first time, a first for a vice president, actually visited an abortion clinic. And here she is.
The reporter said, well, you've made history, I guess, again, because, you know, I did. But the reason I'm here is because this is a healthcare crisis.
I'll just note that her comments come as abortions are on the rise in the United States, despite the bans, and since the Dobbs decision. More than a million abortions in the U.S. in 2023, the highest rate in more than a decade, and a 10% jump from 2020. Many of them linked to medication abortion. And as you know, several states announced just a few weeks ago that they would be offering the medication for the medical abortions in drugstores. And those are only in states where abortions are legal, so it's limited. But there, I think some people may be aware, there is very much an underground campaign to supply women in states where it is not legal. So there you go. Is this a winning issue for President Biden?
Definitely, of course. Is it the only issue? No. Is it, I think one lesson from our entire conversation today is no one of these issues is going to move the polls in a major way. But the stew of priming, the stew of considerations voters think about when they A, decide whether or not they're going to turn out, and B, decide who they're going to vote for, if reproductive rights is at the front, if at the survival of democracy is at the front, Joe Biden's going to be president. If it's, you know, economics, of some elements of economic discussion, if it's grievance politics, then Donald Trump is going to win. So having reproductive issues, having the vice president visit an abortion clinic, because abortion is healthcare, it is good for the Biden administration. And more importantly, it's good for women's health.
And I will add that there are now more stories of women who wanted to have their babies. I think the narrative has been women not wanting to have be pregnant. There are all these women who wanted to have children who have these problem pregnancies. And when I say problem, I mean life-threatening, who cannot now be treated in certain states because their physicians are afraid. They don't know where the law begins and ends. And so there they are, left in this horrible state of being, as the woman that we became familiar with from Texas was forced to go out of state to try to deal with it so that she could, in future, A, not lose her life, but also have an opportunity to have another child if she wanted.
Yep. It's the politics of, I'm doing air quotes again, deservedness, we call it in public policy, that individuals who are unsure, they maybe don't care that much about abortion, they don't think it affects their lives, air quote, these are air quote deserving victims, right? And which is problematic, but that's the way policy and politics works. So all of a sudden, wait for that mushy middle, people like me can be affected. That's getting those marginal voters, those voters that might be deciding between Trump and Biden. Those stories are effective for swing voters.
That blue issue is not just a home run as a political issue because it is such a horrific thing. It does exactly what you want issues to do. It both mobilizes your own forces and it forces the other side to deal with it, right? So Republicans can't just get away with, they can't go away from it. They've got to find some way to combat it. That is resources and rhetoric that has to be devoted to it. So it's a strategic home run. One of my four kids is a young woman in college in Ohio, and she had never been particularly politically minded, but when she had an opportunity to switch her voter registration to vote for a constitutional amendment in Ohio, you can bet that she and all of her friends at her college were really pumped about being able to do that. And so this is a bunch of people that were college kids who generally don't give a crap about politics. So this is an energizing issue. And it's energizing people who aren't normally engaged. So it's a real, it's an absolute home run. And it has been the most significant factor in the success of Democrats in the last several cycles.
Yeah, psychologically, we react more strongly to the fear of losing things we have than to the potential gain of something we don't have. And that's what this issue is. The Republicans have taken away the rights of women to control their reproductive health care. And so we see this. I think it's something the Democrats can certainly use. And the fear is that we want to protect IVF now and so forth. No, you don't. The fear is there that when they say they're going to do stuff, they actually do it. And I think this is a very, very strong issue. And I expect to see it emphasized throughout the campaign by the Democrats.
Given that the big caveat is that we're in March and we have a lot of time before November, I will pose this question. How would you balance weigh on one side President Biden, most recently coming out with some economic grants? He's just announced a whole other forgiving of student loans. Obviously, he's sending out Vice President Harris to make the case for reproductive rights. Those things appear to be his strength right now. Then we have former Vice President Trump. He's got all of the state's organizations in his pocket. So he has a whole party lined up for him. There's no wiggle room there for, I don't care what anybody says at this point. You get on the Trump train or you're just not in the party. Though he has some legal issues to contend with, he seems to be so far managing. How do you assess each of those sides at this moment? And I should say, on President Biden's side, on both of their sides, they're dealing with immigration. And on President Biden's side, of course, he has Gaza, and that's not making him appeal to a lot of people in this moment.
At this point, there is some issues with his control of party apparatus. State Republican parties are in a terrible way financially, and now there is a rift developing between those who want money for Republicans to actually be used for Republicans as opposed to defending the president in court. So he's got some serious problems in terms of of the organizations in the states, and certainly now with his daughter-in-law as the co-chair of the RNC, there's a lot of pushback. Let's remember that where are the big Republican donors to pay the bond for him? They're having some real trouble in raising money. They're being forced to rely on candidates who can self-fund. Ostensibly, that was one of his attractive features, but he has never been that guy, and now everybody knows it. And that is going to create additional problems organizationally for the president and for the party.
All right, Mo, how do you see it?
I think to allude to something we touched on a little earlier, I think when we get back to the fact that this will really come down to six states, we all know which six states they are. They're all very close. They're all within what pollsters would call a margin of error, even though I'm not very high on pollsters these days. Mm. But they're really within what the Democratic strategist Michael Podhoretzer calls the margin of effort. So the numbers are so small in these states that the margin of effort that is put into this on both sides, but I really want to focus on the Democratic side, to defeat MAGA will be decisive. And so I think that is the thing to look for in the next several months.
All right, Erin, you have the last word.
I would say, thank you, A. But this strikes me as a battle. Joe Biden is going after people's heads, their brains, you know, like you said, Kelly, touting student loan accomplishments and just going through a lot of his policy accomplishments and working the party apparatus that exists, you know, opening up new campaign offices, doing get out the vote efforts, getting those up early. And Donald Trump is hitting with emotion, one's heart, if you will. It's a politics of blame and taking over the GOP apparatus with true loyalists. Now, you know, most presidential candidates do take over the party apparatus, but they don't do it quite the way Donald Trump has.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, and I will hear your voices here again well before November. So we'll see how it's going. And I thank all of you for joining us.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
Erin O'Brien is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts Boston. Gerald Duquette, Professor of Political Science and Director of the Public Policy and Management Program at Central Connecticut State University. And Mo Cunningham, former Associate Professor of Political Science at UMass Boston. They're all members of the Mass Politics Profs blog. That's it for this week's edition of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. Listen to us online at GBH News or wherever you get your podcasts. And follow us on Twitter and Facebook to stay up to date with our programming. Under the Radar with Callie Crossley is a production of GBH, produced by Jesse Steinmetz and engineered by Dave Goodman. Our intern is Tu Lee. Our theme music is Fish and Chips by We Are Two Saxies, Grace Kelly and Leo P. Listen again on Wednesday and see you here at 6 p.m. next Sunday for a new episode. I'm Callie Crossley. Thanks for listening.